probably about 3.5 years ago, a gentleman by the name of Eric Kenneth Maine was in a conference. It's still in the COVID days. So it was something that he did, you know, on Zoom. And he was an expert on the Idaho Indians. He was one of the historians, and now he's at the University of Michigan. And basically what he said is he had great information on the Native Americans themselves, but he really didn't have much on how, and he had all sorts of questions that he couldn't answer. And you know, I'm in my rocking chair at home saying, I know. So when Michelle Simeon at the museum asked me to give a talk on something, I said, you know, this is something that I think that can, you know, help straighten out some stuff, and I'll just go ahead and do this. So I put this talk together. I also volunteered to help archives. So I had an idea on some of the really, really cool things that we had in there. So I was able to combine that together with some other things and did a talk. And that was in July of 2023, so almost exactly 3 years ago. And the other thing that really helped me out is there's this wonderful primary reference. A lot of you have probably heard about Juringa, who is a local author who writes a lot of historical documents. He had put something together on the Old Wake Mission. And this was a 600-page book that only Bob could write with help from Bill Van Apthorn. And what they did is that suddenly people realized that Reverend George Smith, who was the missionary in charge of the Old Wake Mission, had diaries that went back from the beginning, with the exception of the year 1867 when the Dutch arrived, or it really liked to happen. But it went all the way to when he retired in like 1880-something, when he had moved elsewhere. And there were records of the financial information, and just kind of notes what happened that day, what he spent, important documents. His wife also put together diaries, and before he became a minister, he and his wife were both high school teachers, and Jordan must have been the math teacher or the science teacher, because it was just, you know, rather cryptic. And she wrote in complete sentences. It's really flowery, and it's really fun to read. But then after a while, she had all sorts of kids, she really kind of quit doing it until right at the end of her life, where she suddenly wrote these remembrances for the newspaper in a Commerce City. And those were also included. Because it was a mission, they had to write annual mission reports, so they included all of that. And also there were genealogies for the Smith and Wakazoo families, and also was dedicated to Charles Lorenz, who was a historian who lived in the Saugatuck area, who had decided back in the 60s that he was going, he also was intrigued by the Old Wake Mission, and actually owned it for a while, and had started to put together all of these papers and lists on what was going on, and a lot of that became part of, you know, at least the ideas that, you know, came to be, you know, parts of this Old Wake Mission book. So, I had that, and those of you who know me know that I love to read. So, of course, I had read 14 other books as I was preparing for this, or reread them, and, you know, just absorbed all of that, and literally just started writing this presentation down, and then corrected it, because I knew I had names wrong, and I had names misspelled, and things like that. So, but that's really how this thing came about. And it was really going to be more about the Old Wake Mission and Chief Wakazoo, but it just really morphed into something else. I thought I'd tell the story more from the perspective of the Native Americans than I would from, you know, I'm a white Protestant Dutch person, which so much of these stories, you know, is told from that perspective. So I suddenly got interested in looking at it from another way. And that's what you're getting today. And so I hope you enjoy it. There's some terms that I really wanted to write up front talk about. The Algonquin Indians. These are the Indians that speak the Algonquin language. There's maybe about a dozen tribes. Most of them are on the East Coast or in New York. But however, there is a group of them, which are commonly referred to as Anishinaabe, who are in the Highland or in the Michigan area. There's maybe like 5 or 6 of them. And some of the tribes are really small, but 3 of the larger ones, which are quite often referred to as the people of the 3 fires, and that is the Ojibwe, the Odawa, and the Potawatomi. So it's like the Chippewa, the Odawa Indians, and the Potawatomi. And I'll try to make sure that you understand what I'm talking about, but sometimes I'll throw up any names, so I just wanted to make sure that you knew up front what I was trying to talk about. So, what are we going to talk about today? We're going to talk about Michigan Indian origin stories. How did the Indians get here? there's different ideas and presents what a few of the Indians were, you know, thought and what they think now. Talk a bit about Michigan Indian history from 1600 to 1800. Just a few slides. It's never talked about. And as I was going through all of these books, it's like there's some really cool stuff here. So I was going to present that. Then we'll switch to the white American perspective and talk about some of the treaties and other things that were written, like from about 1820 to 1850. We'll then talk about the Wapizu family, including the direct family and the extended family, because there's some really interesting people involved and some people that really were the leaders of the Ovalle tribe. And we'll kind of go with that till, you know, from 1800 to present. So, put your seatbelts on. As far as the origin story for the Ovalle Indians, if you talk to Eric Hemingway, who gave this talk at the Howard Museum, he would say we've always been here. And 10,000 years ago, they found new artifacts. This is that there were Native Americans in the area, and he just feels that he's part of that tradition, which is cool. But there's also a lot of people that think that the immigration story actually starts on the East Coast. About 1,000 to 1,500 years ago, the people that were really the Anishinaabeg decided that they wanted to leave the East Coast and go west. And what they did is they were looking for the land where food grows on water. And that is what they finally interpreted as the wild rice that grows here in Michigan and in Wisconsin. And once they found that, they said that's where they had to stop. Unfortunately, this went through Iroquois territory, which were their enemies. And the Iroquois did not like the fact that they were going through there, and not only going through there, but stopping, you know, for long periods of time. So this developed into a war that was referred to as the Beaver Wars. It went for many years. However, the Anishinaabeg finally arrived in Michigan in about 1600. So, what was going on in the 1600s? You gotta remember, this is right when you got, you know, the British arrived in Plymouth, Massachusetts. The British were always interested in colonization. They were okay if they made money off of the beavers and things, but they really weren't all that much interested. They really wanted the territory for settlement. And the British decided to really support the Iroquois Indians, while the French decided they were going to support the Algonquin Indians. And there were always wars going on. And I just skipped the slide, there we go. And the French finally settled in Quebec in the early 1600s, around 1608. And they were always into the fur trading. There never were a lot of French that came over, at most maybe just a few thousand. And a lot of the French would come over, they would have a wife in France, they would have a wife in Quebec, and they would have another Native American wife as they were going out as fur traders and, you know, collecting furs. And it was all a matter of making money. They did establish good relationships with the Native Americans because they would marry into these extended families, which you can almost call like a tribe or a clan or something like that. But it was something that was always very clear to the French that even though they thought they were in control, the Native Americans really were in control. So they were really dictating terms. They were saying, you know, this is what you needed to do to keep us happy. And that's what they did. So finally in 1655, the Beaver Wars ended. The Indians, mainly the Chippewa and the Ogallala, tracked a large war party up by Sault Ste. Marie and literally slaughtered them. There were like 700 warriors that were killed. They let two go just so that the Iroquois knew what had happened. And that was really the end of the war. They would have skirmishes after that, but nothing that was as total war as the Beaver Wars again. And also right about this time, the French were starting up, you know, various trading stations, and sometimes it would develop into forts. There was one down by St. Joseph, Niles, Michigan, that area. This is just a very small fort. There were 10 soldiers there, and literally they were there to guard the booze and guard the furs. But Fort Michilimackinac, which, you know, there's now a fort there also. That was the big one, and that's also where the Ogallala Indians, they were mainly on the south coast, right around the Straits of Mackinac. That's where they settled. They had various villages there, and what they would do is they would settle in villages while the Ojibwe and the Palawans, who were the other two members of the Free Flyers, they would quite often settle in smaller groups, and they would move around a whole lot while they now were much more settled in one space and then they'd build villages. So moving on to the 1700s, all of the resources around the Straits of Mackinac were pretty much disappearing. So the Indians, the Odawa, they moved to the northwest corner. Those of you who have been in the Tunnel of Trees, that's right where their homes are. There's a series of, you know, starting like Petoskey, Chautauqua, going up from there. There's like five villages that they settled. Many thousands of Odawa were in that area. The other thing that they did is they started moving towards the Grand River. And they established a series of villages along there. And so, you know, those are kind of the two places where the Odawa ended up. There was Monsieur Cadillac, who was French. He had been the commander of Fort Michilimackinac. He decided to shut it down. He thought he could make more money if he changed it over to Detroit. And so he shut down the fort, he got a promotion, went back to France, and then Fort Michilimackinac was reopened up because it was so strategic for gathering furs. French and Indian Wars came along, and the Native Americans got involved, but not really that much. You know, it was once again the Iroquois on the British side, the Algonquins on the French side. The French lost. They settled with the British. But the Native Americans were not involved in the treaties, so they never felt that they had actually lost. But then when the British came along and claimed all the French forts and cities, they were suddenly saying, okay, guys, you have to listen to us, like, and the Odawa and everybody was kind of like, excuse me, so have you ever heard of this guy named Pontiac? And then he went up and slaughtered all of the soldiers who were at Fort Michilimackinac. It was called the Pontiac Wars, and really, Detroit was not captured, and Fort Pitt, which is by Pittsburgh, those were not captured, but other than that, they pretty much wiped out every British person who was west of the Allegheny Mountains. The British came back, conquered it back, then they had the Revolutionary War, they lost it all, and they sort of kind of turned things over to the Americans, but it took a while, and the Indians liked the Americans even less than they liked the British. So this broke into another set of wars called the American Indian Wars. A lot of them were fought in Indiana. You may have heard of a guy named Tecumseh, the Prophet. There's just a series of battles there. Sometimes the Indians would win a little bit, but then the Indians would lose. And by the end of these wars, so by the end of 1814, the Americans were really in charge, and the Indian population had just been absolutely decimated in Michigan. Besides that, once the British came along, they also introduced a lot of smallpox into the native population. So between that and the wars, the population of the Indians in Michigan just really, really dropped off. So the Odawa homelands, we talked about the villages in the north, just north of Charlevoix. Also, the villages along the Grand River, they were all nominally Catholic. The French had been Catholic. They never really converted them, but there were missions. It was something where so many of the Catholics, because of all of the Indian wives, there was a lot of mixed race people that would become Catholic, but there never were enough priests to really come around with tens of thousands of Indians to become Catholics, like the Spanish did in California and Mexico and that. So by 1800, there were like 2,000 to 3,000 Odawa in Michigan. And by the end of 1814, it was even lower than that. Maybe it was down to less than 10,000. So, what do you do? One of the things that was happening is that we now get introduced to Chief Wakazoo. And there's actually three Chiefs Wakazoo. And what I do is I refer to Chief Wakazoo and his brothers as the brothers. And Joseph Wakazoo, Sr., his picture is back there. And he was somebody who really had ties into Lake Manitoba, or Lake Winnipeg in Manitoba. And he spent a lot of time there. But he was also one of the chiefs of the Middle Village And he also was somebody who liked to summer up there and then winter somewhere a little bit warmer. And he loved it by Lake Nakatawa, especially near the Wapazoo Woods. So he had Wapazoo Woods where he would stay. There was Point Superior there, which is really where a lot of the villages were, which is where Maryville Lodge is now. And it was something where he just kept going back and forth. He had about 150 Indians that, that accompanied him, so kind of the 300. It was really kind of loosey-goosey. But all in all, that's kind of the way that he lived his life. He had four other brothers, one of which was called Black Hawk. And Black Hawk is somebody who was really, among these four brothers, he was the one who was the intellectual. He was also the one who was really the healer. So he did fight for the British in the War of 1812, but afterwards he stayed as a chief and somebody who really tried to keep things together and help the Indians survive. Another brother was called the Wing, and he was actually somebody who decided to support the Americans. And he and Governor Castle Howland, Michigan, were really good friends. So whenever he needed something, he would just go talk to the governor and he would help him out. There was also another Indian called Blackbird. And he was the one who really was the main chief in the family. And I wish I could show you this because one of the national treasures in the Canadian Museum of History is this canoe that he made, about 3 feet long. It has six warriors in it, including him and his brother, Wayne. And it's one of their national treasures and something that he did like in 1820 to give to one of his friends. And there was another brother involved. His name was Goodhart. I just have never found any information on him. So he's one of those, I need to keep up looking for him, and maybe I'll find something cool about him that I can talk about in the next presentation. How are we doing? Everybody hanging in there? I wish you had the slides. Great. Yeah, thank you. So, when we're talking about the Joseph Wapazoo family, he was from Middle Village, so when you picture those three villages along the tunnel and trees, he came from the middle one, and he was one of the senior chiefs there. So, that's the one that he would start and come down into the Howland area. And it really wasn't a bad life. You spend summers up north, winters in the south, kind of sounds like a lot of us. But, so what also happened is that he and his family became Protestants. Almost all the other Native Americans were Catholic, but there was a Catholic mission in Middle Village, and I think somehow the priest there must have pissed him off or pissed his family off. Because they all switched over and became Protestants. Beyond that, I really don't know. Something else I need to keep my eyes open for. Joseph Sr. had a wife. Her name was Choni. And she was also one of the leaders of the women on the women's side. And they had three children. One of whom was Charlotte Kempbaugh. And she was a healer. And she was also somebody who was very involved in the Old Wing mission, keeping that together. And then later, when the Native Americans moved back up north, she was one of the founders of the church up there. And then the middle son was Joseph Jr., who was our second chief Wapazoo. We'll talk a bit more about him. His wife was Topeka. And it was really those three women that really helped with the Old Wing mission and kept it together. And when you look at the diaries, especially Arvilla Smith's, she quite often was suffering from depression because she would not see anybody, European or American, for long periods of time. But she would always say at the end of it, but the Native women, the Native Indian women are treating me great. I have nothing to complain about that. And that was mainly these three women that all had their residents really close to where the Smith family lived. The last brother we need to touch on is Peter Wapazoo, and he's our third chief. And he became chief after his brother, Joseph Jr., passed away. We'll talk more about him, too. So, 1820s, the Americans are in charge. They want land. What do? They start putting together treaties. And there's about 40 treaties or so that covered the state of Michigan. And each one was reducing the amount of benefits to the Native Americans. And each time, they really didn't do what the Americans never did what they really were supposed to do. So this treaty involved the land south of the Grand River, kind of in the southwest corner. And it was really where all the Potawatomi lived. So the Odawa and even the Potawatomi, they're small Americans here. Sure, you want to give us money, you want to pay our bills, and you want to give us money every year. Yeah, we're real happy with this. There's just a few traders. But then things started happening. Protestant missions were started in Grand Rapids. And this was in 1823. The first one lasted 3 days, and the Indians burned it down. But then they thought, you know, maybe we should keep this around, because they had things like blacksmiths that would fix their weapons. And it really wasn't all that bad. And at that time, the Indians had a village, which was right where Grand Rapids Public Museum and the Gerald Ford Museum is. They had up to 1,000 people in there. And also, there's another Protestant missionary. Some of you have visited this up on Mackinac Island. Reverend Ferry, who later on went to Grand Haven, started a mission up there that was very well received. And he did it for 10 years, and then he founded Grand Haven. So he probably heard of a guy named Louis Campbell, who was a trader from Detroit, and he decided to move to Grand Rapids and become a fur trader there. He also decided that since the Native Americans were on, where you had the pitch on the west side of the Grand River, I will start a village on the east side of the Grand River. So he had his trading posts and a few other things there, which is right now where downtown Grand Rapids is. So he likes to refer to himself as the founder of Grand Rapids, and so do a lot of other people, kind of ignoring the fact that there was a 1,000 people village on the other side. I just find that to be kind of humorous. So what else happened in 1826? Erie Canal. Suddenly the settlers had a very easy way to come out west, and Michigan and Detroit was one of the places that they really started to come to. Oops. So, 1830, Indian Removal Act of 1830, Andrew Jackson. And really, the Potawatomi in southern Michigan were just moved out. The Cherokee had the Trail of Tears, the Potawatomi had the Trail of Death. So, I don't want to do this, I think that kind of explains how bad it was. They were forcibly moved to the other side of the Mississippi River. A lot of the Potawatomi Namboosted went up to Canada, where there was lots of space. But it's something that they had to do, and sometimes they would go out west and then they would come back. Peter Blockazoo had been out west on one of the groups and said, "We don't want to go out there. This is really bad." So he was someone who just was always very insistent that the Odawa wanted to stay in Michigan. So, not quite all of the Potawatomi were forced. A few of them were able to stay. There's a guy named Louis Buchanan who had converted to Catholicism in 1830. He had asked in Detroit to have a priest come out to his village. They actually had the priest buy some land for them. Another whole story was the priest bought the land and said, "Oh, thank you very much. This is," and never quite gave it back. So there's some lawsuits about that later, but we won't go there. And then was something where in the end they were allowed to stay. There were also several Protestant missions that were right around Gun Lake. And there were just a few Indians that were still remaining there, were actually allowed to stay there. But these were also the Indians that, a lot of people came back into these areas. So that's what made up the Gun Lake tribe. Casino? Taking casinos? So, you guys say more. In between 1830 and 1835 is when Grand Haven was founded. That's when Sagatuck was founded. There was a village called Singapore that disappeared. Allegan was founded in 1834. I think you may have heard of this little village called Superior, which was in Wakazoo Woods, and it was right on Superior Point. That's why Superior Point is called Superior. It was a small village that was started by some people from Kalamazoo. They had big plans, lots of money. Bought 1,000 acres, platted land on both the north and the south side of Lake Mackitawa, and very few people came. For a while, the channel was open to get into Lake Mackitawa, and it filled in, and that was it. And
then also John Bates was murdered in Kalamazoo in 1841, so that really did a dip. At most, they had a shipyard, they had a tannery, they had a blacksmith shop, what else did they have? They had a sawmill and about half a dozen houses. So that was Superior, but by 1842, it was done. And also, Chief Wakamatsu's senior dies in 1845, so his son, Chief Joseph Wakamatsu Jr., took over. So, another treaty. We need more land. So, Joseph Wakamatsu and his cousin, Augustin Hamlin, headed to Washington with some other people, and they wrote this absolutely fantastic treaty. They got lots of money to pay off their debts. They had money to buy food because there was some famines going on, not very good harvest for a few years. And the Indians always had the saying, if you're hungry, you can always eat fish. I think after 2 years, they eat enough fish and they were ready for something else. So it was also money to pay off the traders like Rich Robinson, Louis Campo, who always sold them goods on inflated prices. And something where, you know, there was a lot of debt, you know, all come out the booze that they were illegally selling to them and everything else. So that all got paid off. And then they also negotiated for money and supplies for 20 years. Money to buy schools, missions, agricultural assistance, all of these things being not totally directed, but at least, the Indians had influence on what was going where. They also had guaranteed areas that they were going to be allowed to settle forever. And it was like, man, we really negotiated a good treaty. And then it made it to the Senate, and the Senate said, yeah, we don't think so. So all of so much of what they had gotten disappeared, including the fact that they could only stay for 5 years, and then they could force them to move somewhere else. So this was really bad. But the Indians were starving. They really needed the money. So they said, well, okay. So this kind of took away all of their lands, really all the way up really all the way up to the Straits and even further east from there. So their lands were, theoretically all sold off to the Americans. Bad news. Well, Joseph Jr. was very smart, and he was somebody who said, what can we do to stay? So he was watching what was going on with Louis Pocahontas, and other things, and he realized, if we owned land, if we were able to have a mission, if we were able to farm and settle down, we would probably be able to stay. So Chief Wakamatsu met Reverend Smith, who we'll talk about in a couple more slides, and asked him to start a mission for them, which he agreed to do. And at that time, Judge John Kellogg had just moved into Allegan, and he was a rich person from New York. He was also the second legislator from Allegan to the Michigan legislature. He was also somebody who had lots of contacts. And he said, yeah, I will help out also. And then there was also an educated Indian in the area who was quite young, Joseph Elliott. He also helped out. So they were able to get all of this worked out where they were able to get two square miles of land, which is where the opening mission house is. And they were able to get permission, they were able to buy it. And they were really smart. They named it Old Wing after the chief, who was good friends with Governor Cass, who was then Secretary of War Cass. So things, all of these things just worked out with them and worked out with them really well. Now, what I really hate to tell you is that I have pictures of some of the original deeds from the Holland Museum. And what these are, after the land was all bought by Chief Wakamatsu, he then transferred it to some of his native friends. So we got two of the original deeds that were these transfers. We also have two tax records from the early 1840s, one of which is for Chief Wakamatsu, whose taxes in 1841 were $1.18. His cousin Mary had to pay 30 cents, so I wish he had taxes like that. And you may remember I mentioned a guy by the name of Charles Lorenz. And what he did is he took all of these native deeds and all the records from it and tried to figure out who lived where. Made some pretty bad mistakes. Other people have updated it, but we have the original document from that also in the Holland Museum, which I think is pretty cool. So, I said I'll mention a little bit more about Reverend George and Reverend Smith. They were from Vermont. They studied to become teachers, met each other, got married. And George really wanted to become a minister, wanted to become a missionary. So he studied to become a missionary. And he was studying, you know, some congregational preacher out there. And the preacher said, you know, right before he was ready for his final exams, "So what do you think about alcohol and what do you think about the Masons?" And George was honest. He said, "I'm a teetotaler. I think it's really bad to drink. And I really hate the Masons." Well, this guy drank and was a Mason. So, needless to say, when he had his exam, he flunked his Greek part of it and was told that he had to go back and study more Greek for being a missionary out in the middle of nowhere. That was kind of a message for him that it was time to move on. So he moved on to Michigan, where his wife, Arbilla, had a lot of relatives, and they set up the mission. I have some information on a lot of the other people that were involved, and I know we're running a little late because of the slides, so I'll skip that. But, you know, there were a lot of people that were very involved in this that, you know, really had some great contributions to it. And come hear this talk again. I'm sure I'll get it again somewhere. And I get to see it a whole school. All right. Old Wing Mission started off really slow. There was money for missions. However, all these other missions had their plans in line, and they just ran with it, got the money, and the Old Wing pretty much ended up with nothing. Even though George Smith was a Congregationalist, his friend Judge Kellogg was a Presbyterian, made connections back east, got $750 to start off the mission, and was supposed to get about $500 a year for Reverend Smith, money for a teacher, money for translators, money for farmers, and really after this, the money really didn't flow. So it was a really slow start. However, then President Harrison became president in 1841, and he was a Whig versus Democrats like Andrew Jackson. He said, you know, we really don't need to move all these Indians across, you know, the Mississippi River. Let's just let them stay. So suddenly, the interest in having this mission there just really all disappeared. So there still were people that wanted to go to the school. So there was lots of interest in the school. Some people did want to farm. And really, you could say that it kind of turned into being three groups, one of which was people that were part of the Waukesha original band that were used to the immigration. And they were really ready to settle down. And they wanted a farm, and they wanted to stay put. However, there were some of the Indians that had been along the Grand River that joined them, and they really wanted to continue in their Indian ways. And then later, I will talk about another person who came along who really mucked everything up. But Oxen finally arrived in 1842. Chief Joseph Waukesha Jr. died rather unexpectedly. He probably had some sort of lung disease, and he died pretty quickly. And then his brother Peter took over for him. And in 1846, right before the Dutch arrived, there were 34 families associated with the mission, and 13 of them were actively farming, and the rest of them were still kind of just being Indians. We'll talk more about that later. So, Catholic influence. If you remember, Louis Campbell started in Grand Rapids. He was a Catholic, so they started a Catholic mission there. It didn't last very long because the Indians didn't last very long in Grand Rapids. So the missionary who was there was Father Wisniewski, who ended up founding St. Andrew's Church, which became the cathedral there. He decided that he wanted to become a missionary also in the Holland area. This was with encouragement from Louis Campbell and the other traders. He wanted to keep these people drinking booze while the Protestants were like, you know, we need to cut this out, we need to settle down. So, he was there, and then a chief by the name of Joseph Mesame, who had been a chief down in the Allegan area, decided to join here because Allegan had gotten up to a population of about 1,000 people in the area where he was living, which was right downtown. I think it probably just continued over. So he needed to go somewhere, so he came with his extended family, which included three sons and their families. admin. We have all of their names, information on one of that. And then we also have his very beautiful unmarried daughter. And that's the only information we have on her. I love some of these records. And then they settled in the what's called the Landing, and that's where Hank's people is now. And Judge Kellogg had sold them some additional land. And what they did is, with the help of Reverend Viscorsi, and with no influence at all from Reverend Smith, they decided to start a Catholic church there, and they built a seminary there, or a cemetery there, but there was absolutely no cooperation between Father Viscorsi and Reverend Smith. Another picture I wish I could show you that includes a map from 1870 that we have in the collection that shows what the Landing looked like. It shows where the village was, it shows where the cemetery was, and I have that right next to a picture of Heinz Pickel that shows you, you know, where was what. I also have some lists from Charles Lawrence, and these are things like who was studying in school at various times. It was also a list of all of the deaths that Reverend Smith reported. And there's about 45 of them over 10 years, which if you have anywhere from 150 to 300 Indians living on the Landing, it's high, but it's not super unexpected. What's also interesting in it is that there was an epidemic that occurred in October, November of 1846, and about 14 people died during this time. It was believed to be either typhoid or cholera or some disease like that. And then also we had some lists of some of the expenses that were occurred during the time of the mission. And these are just some of the lists of 100 things we prepared. But it's just interesting to see how little money they were getting by with. The Dutch arrived January 1, 1847, and the Admiralty came. Indians were initially supporting them a lot. The Indians went north for the summer like they usually did, came back to ask for chaos. At that time there was about 1,500 Dutchmen running around Holland, taking all of their equipment, their food, their shelters, their maple sugar equipment, and said, "The Lord has provided, thank you very much." And some compensation to the Indians, but not nearly enough. There was some retaliation by the Indians. However, there really wasn't much that they could do, except for get the heck out of there. And they were seeing all the diseases that the Dutch had, especially smallpox, which was basically a death sentence for them. One of the things that Reverend Smith did do is have the doctor from Grand Haven come down and inoculated any of the Indians that wanted to be inoculated for smallpox, which I think probably saved some lives. But still, they were like, we're out here. And the Dutch were intimidated by the Indians because the Indians had dogs, and the Dutch had no idea what a big, scary dog was. So they just kind of stayed away from each other. And the Indians were like, we're going to get out of here. And then Reverend Smith decided to join them. And it was something where Xavi, who had been such a pain in the butt, that Reverend Smith and Chief Walker, Peter Wakazoo, was talking to the Indian agent, what can we do about this guy? He said, oh, it's really simple. We'll just take him off the list. He's no longer an Indian that gets any support for anything. And he died about a year later. So, that's one way to deal with it. This is after he almost murdered Peter Wakazoo and somebody else. So he was later in life, probably a little deranged, literally. And that was it. So, what Reverend Smith and Reverend Viscorsi did is they made very clear that they wanted the Native Americans to get good money for their land. They had bought it for about $1 or $25 an acre, and on average they sold for $5 an acre. Some of that 1,360 acres went for as much as $20 an acre, some of which went for a lot less, but it was something where they just said, we're going to make sure that the Indians don't get taken for that. Indians left to go out north to Montezuma. And that was on June 1, 1849. One of the other really cool things that we have, this is actually in the archives at Hope College, is that they have the receipt for Reverend Viscorsi buying the Catholic Church from Peter Wakazoo for $24. And that he was using it sort of as a center for the Dutch that arrived, have a place to stay, store their stuff. And then that lasted a few years, and then then it disappeared. But I thought that was kind of my, you know, white Protestant. There was another treaty that popped up in 1855, and this was one of the treaties that finally said, okay, Indians, you can stay in Michigan. It established a quote-unquote reservation up by the tunnel trees up in that corner, and the streams of the land up there, very little that had been taken by white settlers at that time. Any Indian got 40 acres. If you were like the head of a family, got another 40 acres. And this land would then become yours after 10 years. There was so much fraud and dishonesty that came about from that, that it was really pretty ugly. And you know, really a lot of the Native Americans have lost their land very quickly over very stupid things. And we wish we had more time to go there, but we won't. I'd also like to talk about the cousins. We had Andrew Blackbird, who wrote this absolutely wonderful biography of his life as an Odawa Indian. It also included a grammar and a dictionary of the Odawa language, which has just been absolutely you know, phenomenally useful for the Odawa as they try to reestablish their culture. He had a brother named William, and William actually went to the Vatican to become a priest. He went to Rome. He and his cousin, Augustine Hamlin. And what happened is that William was just about ready to be ordained, and he was murdered. And at this point, Augustine, who was there a couple years behind him, was told to come home immediately. The Vatican was like, hey, you got any other Indians that want to come and get, you know, get educated? They very quickly said no, needless to say. And you know, that was it for that. Most of the other people that I'm going to talk about, most of them actually did become ministers. Augustine Hamlin did not. He actually had been at the Vatican in Rome, so he actually had the equivalent of a college education. He was the guy who negotiated the Treaty of 1836 with Chief Wapasu Joseph Jr., and he just became one of the educated leaders that was trying to explain to the Indians, you know, what to do and how to do it. We've got Joseph Wakazoo III, who was the son of Joseph Wakazoo II. He fought in the Civil War. He was wounded in the hand. And then after that, he became a minister, and Episcopal minister. And then also was somebody who really tried to help out the tribes as much as he could. We have a gentleman by the name of Payson Woods. His mother was Charlotte Kennequa, who was the healer, who was the lady who was at the Old Wing Mission, really helping things out. He was her only son that survived. And what I should also say is almost all of these people went down to Ohio, either to Cincinnati or to Cleveland or to Asheville, where there were Indian schools there that were really good. So people were going there to get educated, not like a lot of the Indian schools that you may have heard about here. But Payson went there, came back, and he married Reverend Smith's daughter, which one was it? Mary Ann. And they had a wonderful marriage. However, he also went to the Civil War. He became part of the first Michigan sharpshooters. He was part of Company I, which is a very famous Indian company there. He got captured, ended up in Andersonville, almost died. Now, that was the really tragic Civil War camp down in Georgia. He was down like 70 pounds or something, came back. He had TSC. He was an alcoholic. His wife really tried to help him, but finally they got divorced. And then he went back to live with his mother. And he survived. He was somebody who just really suffered from the Civil War. And then last, we have Reverend George Smith Jr., who comes into this as a cousin because he married into the family. And he was somebody who also became a minister. And he was like the minister who took over after his father passed on. And also continued to lead the Indians. We're getting towards the end. Many Indians lost their land. As they lost their land, as logging lumbering was going on, a lot of them became lumbermen. There were various small villages that formed. The Indians had been used to living in extended families, so this worked out well for them, sort of, kind of. And they became subsistence farmers, hunter-gatherers, at least they lived. A lot of the Indians became part of the military. And a lot of the Indians and a lot of these small villages really became hidden in Lots of alcoholism. The boarding schools really messed up a lot of people. Another whole subject we're not going to go into. However, then you got the casinos. And the casinos provided money to the tribes, and they really used that to recover, you know, provide things that they needed, providing schooling, providing things that were very Indian related, and spending it exactly where they wanted to spend it. So, I was going to tell you about Wahoo End and how I think that the U got ended, got added. I always seen it being W-A-K-Z-O-O, and suddenly, in one of the Bob's very good books on Park Township, I saw that in 1903, which is the oldest one that I'd ever seen, suddenly had the U in it. I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on here? Then I realized, oh yeah, my good alma mater, Hope College, had bought Wahoo Woods in 1867. The father was going to make it into a peach farm, and then the peaches developed a blight, so that wasn't good. They were going to have a college there, like, you know, like my alma mater, Northwestern, where they were going to have a university. However, the funding dried up for that, so that never happened. And then in 1901, they finally sold it to some investors in Chicago. And these are the folks that built the Wahoo Inn. For some reason, they added you. I have no idea why. Maybe it looked a little better. Maybe they didn't know how to spell. I don't know. But that's where the U, I think, came from. So I'm looking for something older than that, that may have a U in it. So that's another one of the quests that I'm continuing. The Old Wing Mission House was purchased after the Native Americans left. And this is the one building that remains from the mission. And it was built in 1846. And was then purchased by Isaac Fairbanks, who had been part of the Old Wing Mission. And his family hung out to it for over 100 years. Charles Lawrence from Chicago bought it for a while. Became part of the Michigan and the National Historic Registers of Historic Places. It's the oldest building in Holland right now. It had been a private residence until 2023. And then it was purchased by LG Energy Solutions. And a group of us decided to protest this. We showed up at a city hall meeting. Right, Linda? Really? No, you were not there, but I think there may have been some other people. You know, we all pleaded, saying, please don't tear down the Old Wing Mission. And Reverend Mayor Bach got in on it, made a wonderful speech. And LG said, you know, we're going to hang on to this building. It's something important to Holland. It's still there, at least it was yesterday. And they say they're going to fix it up, make it into a little museum or something. But we're still waiting